From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Jay Leno, the host of The Tonight Show, has a new memoir about his years as a struggling comic, doing stand-up in strip joints and sleeping on the steps of comedy clubs. We'll talk about those early years and about The Tonight Show, and we'll hear him read from his new book. Jay Leno, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Like just about every young comic of his generation, Jay Leno's early dream was a guest spot on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. A lot of Leno's friends got their chance before he did, but he's the one who finally inherited the show. Now he has a new memoir that explains how he got there, with lots of funny stories about his family and his years on the road, playing bars, strip joints, and comedy clubs. His memoir, Leading With My Chin, is also out in CD form featuring Leno reading from his book. Before we meet him, let's hear a reading from his CD.
I'm a half-breed of the oddest sort, one part Scottish, one part Italian. The combination makes no sense because each side couldn't be more diametrically opposed. My mother, Catherine, was born in Scotland, and my dad, Angelo, was a first-generation Italian-American. And I seem to be divided right down the middle. My Scottish side, practical, analytical, even a bit frugal. The Italian side, loud, outgoing, ready to laugh and be laughed at. Of course, my mother never really understood the Italian part of my behavior. When I was a boy, she would always scold me, "There's a time to be serious and a time to be funny." But in truth, there was never a time to be funny. We could be at Disneyland. My mom would say, "Not now! Not now, Ma. When am I supposed to be funny? We're at Disneyland. Seems like it's always time to be serious." She would later watch me do my stand-up comedy and make little notes. I'd ask how she'd like the show, and she would say, why can't you sing a little song and do a little dance? Nobody likes jokes all the time. Nobody wants someone to be funny all the time. The most entertaining spectacle of my youth was to watch both sides of my family try to interact. Each side obviously had totally different attitudes and approaches to life. At the Italian functions on my father's side, there would be hundreds of meatballs for maybe 8 people. More food than anyone could possibly eat. Huge pots, huge portions. My mother's sister, Aunt Nettie, would be incensed by this. "Look at the food, Jamie. The food that's going to waste. The waste!" If there were more than 2 lights burning in any room, she'd scream, "I can't believe it. All these lights. The waste of electricity, Jamie. The waste!" Then we go to my Aunt Nettie's house, which was run on the safer side of frugality. But my Aunt Nettie was a very lovely woman. She came to America when she was a small girl, and my mother followed her years later, moving in with Nettie and her husband Alec. Now, Uncle Alec was the classic Scotsman, by which I mean extremely thrifty. I remember my dad telling this story about when my Uncle Alec fell down and lost consciousness for a few minutes. My dad was there and bent down to help. He shouted, "Give him some air," and opened Alec's shirt, and then put his hand around his waist to try and loosen his pants. At that moment, Alec snapped awake and started squeezing my dad's hand so hard he almost broke it. "You're not getting me, wallet, Angus! You're not touching me, wallet!" My mom's family used to call my dad Angus instead of Angelo. I think they thought Angus was Scottish for Angelo. Anyway, my dad thought this was the funniest thing he ever heard of when he got, you know, the feeling back in his hand.
Jay Leno, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The passage that we just heard had to do with your parents, and I really love the way you talk about your parents. You really express the frustration that you had with them, but you obviously loved them so much.
Well, yeah, I had great parents. I mean, most comics, you know, again, I'm sorry they weren't incestuous or drinking or beat me or anything, so I don't have any excuse. Most comics that I've read about or met always seem to have these horrible childhoods, and the comedy come out of this horrible pain, which is legitimate, certainly. It just didn't work that way for me. For me, the humor was always the fact that my parents were in their 40s when I was born. And besides my mom being an immigrant from Scotland, my mom being Italian, the differences were so horrific.
Your dad being Italian?
Yeah, were just hilarious to me. I mean, I'll never forget, you know, in that sort of teenage rebellion thing. I remember I was in the eighth grade when the Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan Show. And, you know, I said, "Hey, Dad, the Beatles are going to be on." You know, my father, Beatles or whatever that is, you know. And so anyway, the Beatles come on and they're singing, "Yeah, yeah, whatever, doesn't want to hold your hand." And I see my dad with the newspaper in front of his face, you know, deliberately not watching, you know. And I just said to him, I said, "You know, Dad, you know, the Beatles write all their own music." And my father just puts the paper down. He says, "Let me tell you something, you know, some manager gives these kids a couple of bucks to go out on a stage and act loony, and you kids all fall for it." And, you know, I couldn't even argue with that. It was so ridiculous. That was my father's whole explanation for the Beatles' career. Some guy gives them a couple of bucks, and they go out, and they act loony.
Was your humor ever considered a behavioral problem?
Yeah, as a kid, I was one of those hyperactive kids, and you know, I was the classic, Jay has the ability, but does not apply himself. You know, if Jay spent as much time studying as he does trying to be funny, I mean, I still have that on my report card from Mr. Simon, my fifth grade teacher, that if I spent as much time studying as I do trying to be funny, I would be a big-time comedian or something like that. And, of course, I hear from Mr. Simon all the time now about, oh, how prophetic he was, and I, you know, and it just kind of makes me laugh.
Do you remember your first laugh in front of an audience?
Yeah. This is sort of a story I've told a lot, but it's the first adult laugh. I remember always doing things. I remember the first thing I ever said that got attention. And I remember I couldn't have been more than maybe 4 or 5. But I remember I was over at one of my aunt's house, and my mom was there. And, you know, all the women were fussing around. There was some sort of get-together going on. In other words, just getting together for coffee or what it was. But it was like me and like 5 women, all my aunts and everything. And I remember saying to my mom, just making this observation. I said, "Mom, why do girls have humps like camels?" Well, of course, woo, 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 all the women, "Oh my God, did you hear what the child said? Woo!" I had no idea what I said. But I remember all the women, excuse me, running around, my mom going, oh, for goodness, and hustling me out of the room, and people laughing hysterically. And I'm thinking, what did I say? What did I say? The co, woo, woo, woo. You know, my aunt, you know, those kind of big women that would fan themselves when they heard something funny. Like this, you know, "Oh, the child should have heard me say." And I never got an answer to my question, but I just remembered that getting this tremendous reaction. And you know, as a comic, I have a sort of a theory about comedians. They always remember everything that got a reaction. Any kind of reaction. Just it's like it makes an etch in your brain, you know? And that was the first thing that ever got a reaction. And then the second time I remember it happening was in the fourth grade, and it was a joke. I didn't think it was that funny a joke, but at the time, it was the first joke I think I ever said that sounded like an adult joke. It wasn't just a kid joke. We were in Miss Allen, who was still a great friend of mine. She was my fourth grade teacher, and she's still teaching now. I realize now that must have been like her first year. And she was teaching us about Robin Hood, and, you know, the Sheriff of Nottingham was very cruel. And I remember her saying that when the Sheriff of Nottingham would catch Robin's men, he would boil them in oil. I remember putting my hand up, and I remember saying, well, he couldn't do that to Tuck. And she said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, he was a friar, you know." Just a stupid joke. And it got kind of a laugh, and then I got scolded for it. But I remember later in the hall, I was walking down the hall, and one of the other teachers said, "Hey, Jay, come here. What did you say in Miss Allen's class? What was the joke you told?" I said, "Oh, they couldn't boil them in oil. He was a friar." "Oh, yes." And then another teacher asked me about it, and I said, "Geez, I like this. You know, this is great, this sort of feeling of influence. This is terrific." And it just always kind of stayed with me.
All he ever wanted was a little bit of attention.
Just a little bit of attention.
Jay Leno is my guest, and he has a new memoir called Leading with My Chin and a new companion CD. And I think, why don't we play one of the stories that you read on the CD? And when you were in college, you had an act with a friend, and the act was called Gene and Jay's Unique and Original Comedy.
That's right.
Yeah, you performed this in coffee houses, and there's a great story about this that I think we'll play from your new CD, Leading with My Chin.
During my first year at college, I lived in a small dormitory where I met a very funny guy named Gene Bronstein. He now lives in Los Angeles, where he writes television comedy, and we still talk all the time. Back then, we quickly discovered our mutual love for comedians and became instant friends.
In the dorm, we started writing bits together, which we would try out in local coffee houses. I think I was drawn to Gene as a comedy partner because he sounded like Dick Cavett, very wry and smart, perfect straight man, as opposed to me. Apparently, see, I was like the loud guy. Anyway, these coffee houses where we worked were very much of that era, post-beatnik havens for protesters of every kind. There was the Orson Welles Theater Cafe, the Sword and the Stone, Cafe Wa in New York, the Nameless Coffee House in Harvard Square. That was the place where Gene and I debuted our comedy act. We billed ourselves as Gene and Jay's Unique and Original Comedy. And that night, as always, we followed some angry guy reading poems that invariably seemed to end with the same line, "Stop your war machine!" The audience would hoot, "Woo! Yeah!" And the poet would gush, thank you, ladies and gentlemen." It was all very incongruous. But it got even more incongruous when we took the stage. For the first time ever, Gene and I performed a bit we called The Lone Arranger. The stupid premise was simple enough. Tonto goes to the bank, take out a loan. I played Tonto. It went like this. "Me want loan." "Yes, sir, I'm the Lone Arranger." "You a Lone Ranger?" "No, the Lone Arranger." "Lone Ranger?" "No, Lone Arranger. I arrange the loans." It was that bad. But it was our first time. Not 3 minutes into it, a woman in the audience screamed at us, "You're being cruel and insensitive to Native Americans. Many Native Americans suffer under the hands of oppression." Well, this just stopped us cold. I said, "Lady, it's a bit about the Lone Ranger and Tonto." "Yes, but by making fun of Tonto, you're making fun of all Native Americans." I said, "It's a guy going for a loan. The joke is not the Indian. It's a mistaken idea. It doesn't matter." You know, suddenly my first gig in comedy had turned into a civil rights rally. Later, however, we just changed a bit and had Tonto say things like, "Nixon, what a jerk. Stop your war machine. Thank you. Good night." It wasn't any funnier, but the applause was tremendous.
That's Jay Leno reading from his new book, Leading with My Chin. What we heard was the companion CD to the book. When you were starting in comedy, there weren't comedy clubs yet, not as we know them. Some of the venues that you played included retirement homes, prisons, mental hospitals. This is through a state program in Massachusetts where I think you got like $10.
We used to get $10 a show to do old people's birthday parties for the state. We used to do prisons. I did a show at like Walpole State Prison. And prisoners are not a good audience, you know, because comedy is based on a certain civility. "Hi, folks, how are you?" You know, and when you got a guy sitting in the front row and he's got a little blonde kid on a choke chain wearing underpants sitting on the floor next to him, that's not an ideal audience, you know.
What material would you do in your
prison?
Just
do your regular act. I only had my act growing up, whatever. You know, I used to do these psychiatric homes, and you know, they get like, you know, and this is not to make fun of psychiatric patients, but, you know, you go there, "Hi, everybody, how you doing?" And then, like, in the middle of your act, there'd be a guy in the corner going, "Ah! Ah!" And then orderlies would come in. And of course, this would just break the mood of the whole room, you know. "Say, anybody here from Boston?" "Ah! Ah!" You know, hey, calm down there, fella. How you doing? You know.
Well, did this give you confidence performing in front of people?
Well, it was fascinating because you realized it wasn't until I performed at, like, this place called Lenny's on the Turnpike in Boston that I ever got a professional audience. You know, I could always say in my own mind, well, you know, the audience, it's a psychiatric hospital. They didn't laugh because there's obviously something wrong with them.
Well, you can say, right, they don't laugh. They're crazy.
Yeah, it was like strip clubs.
Yeah.
When I would play strip clubs, they wouldn't laugh or applaud or do anything. But it gave you the confidence just to stand on stage because the people weren't paying any attention to me anyway. I mean, there's a story in the book about playing this club called the Mineshaft, where it was in Minnesota. People would pay $5 to get in. And then for another $5, the customers would get a miner's hat with a light on it. Now, there were no lights in the club. It was just a big, empty building. And the women would come out and dance. And, of course, the guys had the lights on their heads, and they would look at whatever part of the woman they wanted to look at with the light. And I would just be standing in the darkness, telling jokes. "Hi, everybody. How you doing?" Occasionally, somebody would look over at me, and I couldn't even look at them because they had the bright light on their head. So if they looked at me, ow, it burned my eye. I had to look away. So most of the time, for the whole week, I was just standing in darkness while guys looked at these women with those miner's hats on.
Jay Leno, his new memoir is called Leading with My Chin. He also has a new CD on which he reads from the book. We'll hear the second half of our interview later in today's program. This is Fresh Air. Jay Leno and I have a lot in common. He started doing stand-up in strip joints, and, well, that's where I started doing interviews. Fresh Air, like The Tonight Show, is famous for the host's funny opening monologues. But there is one big difference. The Tonight Show has commercials, whereas Fresh Air is listener-supported. So please call and make a pledge during this National Fundraising Week for Public Radio. Rock historian Ed Ward has the blues, two box sets of the blues, released by the Smithsonian. They've provided Ed with the right mix of recordings he needed to give us a five-part survey of this all-important American musical form. We'll feature the series every day this week. The collections he's drawing from are The Blues, a general survey which came out a few years ago, and the newly released Mean Old World, a history of the blues since 1940. We begin the series with a look at the first years of the blues and the people who recorded them.
I am broken home, where riding dirty too. I said I'm broken, hungry, riding dirty too. Mama, find me enough, can I go home with you?
No other musical form has had such a profound impact on 20th century American music, and hence the music of the world, as the blues. The earliest African American musical forms documented were string band dance tunes virtually indistinguishable from white old-timey music with which they had a history of interaction. Following this came ragtime and songster music, often played on the guitar, which used some of the rhythms and blue notes of the blues. The noted pop music composer W.C. Handy, erroneously called the father of the blues, tells in a famous excerpt from his autobiography of waiting for a train in Mississippi in 1903 and hearing a dilapidated black man playing a guitar with a knife blade and singing a song in which the first line is repeated and finished with a second line. This was the blues, and it's unlikely it was much older than the century itself. Handy went on to compose some pop songs, which he called blues, but weren't. Still, it didn't take long for the infant record industry to dip a tentative toe into this new music. Mamie Smith's 1920 Crazy Blues was a pop song with one section that was sort of in blues form, but it sold like wildfire and sent talent scouts out looking for more, and thankfully more talented, blues singing women like Gertrude Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith. Her 1923 Jailhouse Blues is a typical blues song with two repeated lines and a finishing third line. But Bessie Smith and Ma Rainey were city blues performers, and the wellspring of the blues was elsewhere.
I ain't got no mama now. Told me late last night, you don't need no mama no how.
Blind Lemon Jefferson was an itinerant singer from Texas who first recorded in 1925, and his impact was considerable. By the time his records became available, phonographs were cheap enough that even relatively poor people, black and white, could afford them, and Jefferson's records sold well. He opened the door for many other country blues performers, and a great many of them came from Mississippi.
Sally, why don't you come home? Sally, why don't you come home? I ain't had no loving girl since you've been gone.
Among other things, as we can hear from this recording by Furry Lewis, Mississippi was the home of the bottleneck slide guitar style, although guitarists elsewhere used it too. Thank you. in fact, probably the greatest slide performance recorded during the 1920s was Texas singer Blind Willie Johnson's Dark Was the Night, which was not only not from Mississippi, but was, like all of his music, sacred music, not blues. Still, there's no denying that since the record company scouts weren't folklorists, they tended to look where they knew they'd find what they wanted, which largely meant Mississippi and Memphis, Tennessee, where a lot of transplanted Mississippians went. Mississippi is a spooky place, and so is much of the music that came from it.
I thought, did you give me gasoline? Out at full bottom, give me gasoline. I thought, and she gave me gasoline. Lord, Lordy, Lord.
Tommy Johnson was one of the first classic Mississippi Delta blues singers to be recorded, and he influenced an entire generation of singers. By the end of the 1920s, blues was established as part of the American musical landscape, but change was coming. Tomorrow, I'll talk about the Depression and how it transformed the blues.
Rock historian Ed Ward. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
When it rained 5 days in the sky, dark as night. When it rained 5 days and the sky turned dark as night, then trouble taking place in the lowlands at night. I woke up this morning, can't even get out of my door. Make a poor girl wonder where she wanna go. Then they rolled a little boat about 5 miles across the...
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, Jay Leno tells us about the advice Johnny Carson gave him. We continue our conversation with Leno about his early days as a stand-up comic and about taking over as host of The Tonight Show. We'll be right back.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our interview with Jay Leno. The host of The Tonight Show has a new memoir called Leading With My Chin, about his early days as a stand-up comic, playing bars, strip joints, comedy clubs, and just about any place that would have him. You were probably one of the most hardworking comics in show business when you were getting started, just performing anywhere and everywhere to get experience. But sometimes you get billed, you'd get booked in really inappropriate places. And my favorite story about that is when you were booked, I guess it was in a Catskill resort at a Hasidic, at an Orthodox Jewish resort.
Yeah, there was this.
You were booked as what? Tonight, Jay Leno, Jewish storyteller.
I was billed as a Jewish storyteller.
What did you do?
This agent in New York would come into the clubs and he'd say, I need a comic this Saturday, pays $50, you know. And I met one time, before I get that story, this guy sent me up to a job and it paid $100 for the weekend. And I thought, well, that's pretty good, $100 for the weekend. And I remember afterwards, the owner of the hotel came over and said, boy, that was very good. You know, normally we don't like to spend $1,200 on an act, but we really enjoyed you. And I realized the agent took, you know, $1,100 commission out of my $100. You know, it's just a nightmare. Anyway, that was the last time I worked from him. And the first time, he sends me up to the Catskills at the Chaim Resort or something like this. And I said, well, what is it? It's just a nightclub. I said, what kind of, I said, is it mostly, oh, no, go up there. So I finally find this place, and it's all these cabins way back in the woods. And nice people, but it's a Hasidic resort. And I pull in there, and it says on one of these, one of those bad signs that, you know, you pull on a trailer and it's got the flashing lights around it. Tonight, Jay Leno, Jewish storyteller. And I go, so I get there and I walk out on stage and it's all Hasidic, you know, and I don't even speak Hebrew or, you know. And I said, listen, it's been a big mistake. You know, I'm not really a storyteller. I'm not even Jewish. The guy made a mistake. And then this guy, so do your act. Let's see what you do, you know. So I did my, and they were very nice. And, I mean, they were polite. You know, I felt bad for them, and they felt bad for me. And they were nice people. It just, it wasn't what they had bought, you know. You know, it was a horrible job.
You know, I think it's funny, in your book you talk about how when you were getting started in comedy, or maybe this was even before you got started, when you were growing up, that comics meant adult guys, usually from New York, usually Jewish, who spoke more to your father than they spoke to you.
That's true. When I was a kid, you had Alan King, you had Rodney Dangerfield, and these guys were always funny, but they always came from the point of view, at least to me, was these kids today with the long hair, you can't tell the boys from the girls, I tell you, you know. And all that was funny. My father would laugh at that. And then I remember seeing Robert Klein and George Carlin and David Brenner and Steinberg, and these guys would come out. And suddenly I noticed I was laughing more than my dad because their humor was coming more from my point of view, especially Robert Klein. He was a guy who was, I felt, like me, middle class, normal parents, not crazy, not rich, not poor, just normal, you know, watched the same TV shows as a kid that I watched, joked about the same kind of things that I watched. And that was a big change in comedy, at least for me.
So how did you figure out where your material was going to be?
I figured it out from watching those guys. You know, I said to myself, boy, these guys make fun of the same kind of things that I think are funny. These are the same things I talk about with my friends. I mean, prior to them, I don't think you would have seen Alan King come on the Ed Sullivan show and do jokes about Jimi Hendrix. You know, it just didn't happen. You know, it didn't happen.
No, it would be about Jimi Hendrix mowing his lawn.
Right. Jimi Hendrix with a hair like that, you know. But, I mean, suddenly here were guys on mainstream television talking about things only kids, you know, now adults buy Rolling Stone albums, you know what I'm saying? But
back
in the 70s, there were adult records, you know, which you had Henry Mancini and Frank Sinatra, and then you had, for the kids, you know, the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, whatever. And nobody ever did jokes about the Beatles on mainstream television. These were the first comedians to sort of parody younger people's lifestyles.
You know, we were talking about how hardworking you were as a young comic, just trying out everything that you could, playing every place you could play. When you moved to Los Angeles, you moved there before you had a home, before you had any money, And you often ended up just like sleeping on the steps of the comedy clubs or sleeping in the alleys by the comedy clubs.
Yeah, I used to get picked up in L.A. for vagrancy. And what the cops would do is they just put you in the back of the car and you just drive around with them on their shift all night. And being a comic, you know, this worked, well, somewhat to my advantage, but actually, no. The first time I got picked up, you know, they'd say, let's move along. Why don't, where do you live? I don't kind of live anywhere. I'm, all right, get in the car. What do you do? I'm a comedian. Oh, yeah? Tell us a joke, you know. So then you'd sort of try and come up with every dirty joke you could think of to tell these cops all night. And har, har, that was Lila. And then that worked pretty good. Well, they let me go. But then two or three nights would go by, and the cops would go, hey, are you that comedian guy our partner picked up the other night? Yeah, you get in the car. All those jokes you were telling. So, you know, two or three nights a week, I'd have to ride around until dawn telling jokes to different cops because they would say, hey, have you seen that kid on the street? Pick him up. He's got some funny jokes.
My guest is Jay Leno, and he has a new memoir called Leading With My Chin. The memoir has a companion CD with Jay Leno reading from the book, also called Leading With My Chin. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jay Leno, and he has a new memoir called Leading With My Chin. Like most young comics, your ambition when you were starting out was to eventually get onto The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
What was the most memorable part of your first shot on The Tonight Show?
Most memorable would be, I got heckled my first shot, which was a horrible experience. But luckily, I'd worked a lot of clubs, so I could deal with that, and Johnny seemed to like that. But our producer, who was still with NBC in The Tonight Show to this day, Fred DeCordova, he would say to you, okay, here's the deal. He would come over and he would say, and Fred was somewhat of a legendary figure, having, you know, directed Jack Benny and all these people. He would say, after you do your stand-up routine, if I go like this, waving my hands towards me, that means come over and sit down to Johnny. If I put my hand up like this, stay on your mark. If I wave you away, go behind the curtain. But whatever you do, don't move until you get my signal. I said, yes, sir. I walk out, I do my routine, and thank you, good night, big laughs, Hannah, thank you very much. I look over, and I see Fred about to signal me, and his phone rings. And I see him, hello? And now he's talking, and I don't know what to do. And the audience is now getting into that, you know, down to that odd one or two claps. And I'm still standing there, so the applause picks up a little bit more, as if people are going, oh, all right, just get lost, will you, you know. And, I'm going, hi, and he's talking away, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da. Now the applause is all but stopped. Fred puts the phone down. He looks over, completely forgetting. Oh, come here. Come on. Oh, thank you. You know, I realize it was only maybe 6-7 seconds. But, of course, to me, I might as well have been out there an hour and a half at this point, just hanging, waiting to get Fred's signal to come over and sit down next to Johnny. So that was pretty scary.
On your first shot on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, did he laugh at your jokes?
Yeah, he was very good, actually. He was a terrific audience. I mean, that's what The Tonight Show is. It's not trying to get the audience to laugh. It's trying to get Johnny to laugh.
Right.
But, you know, the audience gets the cue from the host.
Right.
And if Johnny is laughing, they're enjoying it more.
Did Johnny Carson give you advice about your stand-up act or later on about guest hosting or hosting when you took over?
Not so much about hosting, but he did about, the first time I did The Tonight Show. Well, actually, I was a guy that was sort of the last of my graduating class to do The Tonight Show. By graduating class, I mean all the guys I sort of started with, Robin Williams and, Letterman and guys like George Miller and so many of the comics, they all did it before me. And You know, Johnny came in one night at the Improv to see me. Harvey Korman brought him in. And, you know, there are two kind of comedians. There are comedians that have a lot of attitude and not many jokes. There are comedians that have a lot of jokes but not much stage persona. By attitude, I mean those kind of comics can get on stage and go, "Hey, pal, nice hat. All right, what did you win? Like, somebody guess your weight?" You know, that kind of thing. And they're loud and they're boisterous and they're just funny in their nature, but there are no jokes. And then there are other comedians like, well, you take a guy like Stephen Wright, who are just natural joke writers. You know, very monotone. They tell the joke a certain way. And to me, the best comedians are the ones that combine both those elements. You have a joke and you have an attitude. I remember Johnny came to see me and he said, you know, he thought I was funny, but I wasn't ready for the show because my jokes were too far apart. You know, I didn't quite understand what he meant, but I listened. And then I started watching his monologue and I realized, you know, he was doing 15 or 20 jokes in a space where I was doing 5. I mean, I could get on stage and being sort of physically big and loud and imposing, I could get a laugh where there wasn't any. But that really, that was great for a nightclub, but not for TV. You know, the idea being on television, if the joke doesn't work, your funny attitude will carry you through. And if your funny attitude doesn't carry you through, your joke will carry you through. And if they both work, you got a killer joke, you know?
Now, how do you work up your opening monologue?
How?
Well, and how do you feel? And also, how do you feel about having writers writing with you? I'm sure during the years that you were doing clubs, you were writing all your own material. And
I was writing all my own stuff, and there's this arrogance that a lot of comedians had, and I certainly have it, or at least had it. You know, well, I can do this. I can handle it. I mean, you know, it's a bit. Comedians tend to be like Democratic presidents. They think they can handle the whole thing themselves. You know. You know, I always said the Republicans elect stupid presidents and brilliant staffs, and Democrats elect brilliant presidents and stupid staffs. And it's the same thing. Comedians are like that. They come in and they say, I can handle it. Like the first 15 to 20 times I hosted the Tonight Show, I said, I don't need cue cards. I'll memorize it. And I did okay. But then I realized this is ridiculous. If you're going to do this every day, you can't memorize, you know, 11 and a half minutes worth of jokes. I mean, you'll go nuts. You'll go crazy trying to do this. And then I gradually got into it. And now the way it works is, well, we tape the show from 5 to 6. Then we have a meeting. I go home at maybe 7:30, 8 o'clock. 9 o'clock, I start to put the monologue together. 11 o'clock, Jimmy Brogan, he's the guy working on the monologue. We go through maybe 500 or 600 jokes that we've prepared that day, or everybody's prepared. And they're not all jokes. Some are just punchlines. Some are just setups. Some are... Did you hear about the guy who did this odd thing in Iowa? ? We try to make a joke out of that. Sometimes it's a complete joke from a writer. Anyway, we'll try and put at least half the monologue together by 2 or 3 in the morning. And then I get into work about 8:30 and through the course of the day, and you're writing jokes constantly as you're picking the red M&Ms out of some rock group's, you know, dressing room, because whatever, you know, you're still dealing with show business people, you know.
You used to be very close with David Letterman. I think you used to write for his show.
No, I didn't write for his show. Dave and I used to write for Jimmy Walker on Good Times.
Oh. So it must be very strange to be rivals now and to both have these kind of like publicity machines in front of you and between you, you know, getting between
whatever
relationship
you have. Well,
you know,
it seems like it should be odd. I mean, it seems like it should be more fun to me, but...
More fun than it is?
Well, you know, both these networks have huge amounts of money riding on these things.
Right.
And, you know, the odd thing is when we were losing by less than a rating point. Now that we're winning by less than a rating point. But America has this rather bizarre mentality that there's number one, and then number two is a million miles away, bloodied and beaten into the ground. And it's not that way. Both these shows are extremely successful, and both make a lot of money. If one year one show makes a couple of $1 million more than the other, so what? Who cares? I mean, late night television is better because both these shows are on. You know, I mean, the more live new programming you have at late night, the more revenue comes to these stations. You know, late night used to be dead. There was Johnny Carson, and that was it. But believe me, if there was only one show, it would probably be on 3 or 4 nights a week, and it would be 10 weeks a year off. Now both shows literally kill themselves trying to put the best shows on the air that they can with the most new entertainment and the funniest jokes they can come up with. I mean, sometimes we both overdo it and go nuts, but hey, that's competition. That's the nature of it. I mean, to me, nothing would be funnier than to switch shows one night. I mean, to have Dave walk out on my stage and me walk out on his stage simultaneously would seem like the funniest thing in the world. But, you know, it couldn't happen because, I don't know, networks would go nuts or something. Or, hey, I would love to go on Dave's show and do a What's My Beef segment like I used to do in the early days. But then NBC would say, oh, you, tonight's show ratings will go down that night. We'd have to put a rerun on. The CBS's ratings will be huge. Or vice versa. So you just sort of have this odd kind of standoff thing that goes on, which seems rather silly to me. Because I'm a fan of Dave's show. I watch it probably 3 or 4 nights a week. And sometimes I think we had the better joke. And sometimes I think, ah, you know, Dave had the better joke on that one. I mean, what it comes down to is he makes me laugh. And the other thing is, there are only 3 or 4 people that you can actually joke about this job with because they're people who have done it. Arsenio Hall, Letterman, Pat Sajak, Johnny. There's only a few people out there that when you bring up a certain phrase or a certain guest that know exactly what you're talking about. And it's odd that we can't all get together and laugh about that the way we used to when we were stand-up comedians.
You strike me as more secure, less insecure than a lot of comics.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty secure that way.
Less neurotic?
No, I'm not neurotic at all, actually. I'm not neurotic at all. I mean, you know, Rich Lewis is a friend of mine, and he, you know, I watch him agonize. You know,
right.
He agonizes over every little thing. What's the joke? You like that joke. You know, Rich will say, here's a joke. He'll tell you the joke, and you go, eh, it's funny. No, you didn't think it was funny. It was funny. Yeah, how funny was it? It was really funny. No, it wasn't that funny. You're being polite. And this will go on for days. It'll go on for weeks if you let it. And, you know, I said to myself, my God, where does that come from?
So you don't understand neurosis?
Well, I mean, I understand it, and I'm lucky I don't necessarily suffer from it.
You're kind of famous for hating vacations, for not liking to not work. You like to work a lot. Is that still true, that you still don't like vacations?
I'm not a vacation guy. You know, I was somewhat dyslexic as a kid, and I always remember my mom saying to me, well, you're just going to have to work that much harder than the other kids to get the same thing. And when you brought up being insecure before, I never thought I was insecure. I just thought I was being lazy. And that may sound silly, but to me, if something didn't work, it didn't work because I wasn't working hard enough. Like when the whole thing with The Tonight Show was going on, is Jay going to be replaced? Is he going to get fired? They're going to replace him with Letterman. Well, obviously 16 hours a day is not enough. Maybe I need to do 18 hours a day. And it worked, you know. I mean, that's what works for me. You know, I never said I was the best. I never said I was the funniest. I just said, I will work at this harder than anybody else. And that seems fair. I mean, that's sort of the American way, you know. I've always been a guy that worked on commission. Even when I was washing cars or had regular jobs, I was never a salary guy. I was always the kind of guy that would say, listen, why don't you pay me by whatever? You know, when I took over the Tonight Show, when I used to go into bars with the $50. If you think it's good, pay me what you think it's worth. And eventually, do you get screwed at the beginning? Yeah, but everybody gets screwed at the beginning. You know, to this day, people say, oh, you're getting screwed. Really? I mean, I do very well. I've hosted the Tonight Show. I got the job I wanted. I mean, it's what works for me. And in my mind, if I'm one of those guys, like if I take a, you know, I went to Hawaii once. This was like a nightmare. I was doing a gig in Hawaii, and I had to stay down there like 3 days. And the second day, I'm sitting on the beach, and I look at my watch, 10 o'clock. I'm sitting on the beach about 4 hours, and I look at my watch, and it's 10:30, and I go, great, my watch broke. The battery's dead. And they asked them, what time is it? And they said, it's 10:30. And I said, really? I've only been sitting here for half an hour? I thought it was like 2 o'clock. This is like a nightmare. Get me out of here. And, I'm not a vacation guy.
It must be strange for you, knowing so many comics so well and having been in the position of being a young, hardworking comic really wanting their big break, to now be the guy who could give a young, hardworking comic
man,
a big break.
Oh, man, it's a nightmare.
And I'm sure you don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. On the other hand, you want to have the best show you possibly can. So it's probably a really awkward spot.
No, it's horrible because I used to think, well, now that I'm hosting The Tonight Show, I can go anywhere. But now you can't go anywhere because you walk in and you go, oh, gee, there's Larry. I got to hide. You know, I mean, that's what it is. I mean, you know, you have friends that come up to you that, you know, it's when I first got the job, men, women, comedians would come up to me and they go, hey, Jay, you know, Johnny would never put me on, but now you got the show. It'll be great, man. I can come on all the time. And I'd have to say, but, you know, if you weren't good enough to get on with Johnny, it's not good enough to get on with me. You got to make it funnier. And, you know, I lost a lot of friends that way. I mean, it's just there are people that I love dearly as friends, but the material is not strong enough. Or maybe it's really old-fashioned, you know. It's just, you know, old jokes about, I don't know, hippies or airline food or whatever it is. And you just say, you know, you got to update the stuff. And they just don't get it.
Jay Leno, his new memoir is called Leading With My Chin. He also has a new CD on which he reads from the book. This is Fresh Air. Let's see, when Jay Leno was getting started as a comic, honing his material on the road, what was I doing? I probably spent part of that time asking public radio listeners to make a pledge. Yeah, well, some things never change. Public radio keeps getting bigger, and we hope better, but what has remained constant is that the system is based on listener support. This is a national fundraising week for public radio. Please join the thousands of people around the country who are calling to support the station that keeps them entertained and informed. Thanks. Tonight, after a much-publicized five-week delay, CBS finally unveils Inc., its new sitcom starring Ted Danson of Cheers and his real-life wife, Oscar-winning actress Mary Steenburgen. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Every TV season turns out to have a theme, and the major theme this year is desperation. NBC made a pilot of Suddenly Susan starring Brooke Shields, then scrapped the entire cast and crew, except for Shields, and started over. On CBS, similar overhauls were done for Bill Cosby's Cosby sitcom and for Ted Danson's Inc. Why are the networks spending so much money and effort this year on trying to improve their big new sitcoms? Because the audience for network TV is eroding, that's why. Fewer people are watching CBS, NBC, and ABC than ever before, so the networks are desperate to draw viewers and keep them at a time when cable TV and 4th, 5th, and 6th networks are fighting for the same attention. Big names, the networks figure, can get people back into the tent. It worked for ABC with Michael J. Fox, whose Spin City arrived in fine shape. It's one of the year's genuine hits. Brooke Shields on NBC and Bill Cosby and Ted Danson at CBS are big names, too, and can be counted on to attract an audience once. But to get them twice and to have viewers keep coming back, the shows have to be good enough. Or, in the case of Suddenly Susan, placed in such good time slots that quality doesn't really matter. With so much at stake, that's why so many of this year's sitcoms have been returned for retooling. Cosby emerged as a very good show. Suddenly Susan didn't. And Inc., which premieres tonight, is better than it was, but the pilot just isn't funny enough. And that's a disappointment, because I really wanted to like Inc. I love Danson in Cheers, and Steenburgen in the movies, and both of them together in Gulliver's Travels. In Inc., in this new version written by Murphy Brown creator Diane English, he plays a star columnist of a New York tabloid, and she plays his long-distant ex-wife, who returns to his life and his paper as the new editor. It's a good premise, but only once, in this scene you're about to hear, do the two leads really sparkle a little.
I really want this to work. So, what do you say? Think we could give this a shot?
Guess we won't know till we try, huh?
Thank you.
Yeah.
That means a lot to me.
No problem.
So, when will I get your column? The earlier the better. I need a chance to look it over.
Kate, no one looks over my column. You know, I write it, you print it. That's the way it works around here.
I write it, you print it. Well, you know, Mike, they brought me onto this paper to put my stamp on it, and that's why I'm going to look over everything before it goes to press.
See, now, there's something you don't know. You see, I am a very big star at this paper. Check out my desk, right next to the coffee. See, that's power.
In too many other scenes, the writing is a little forced and the performance is a little broad. I'm not giving up on Inc. This cast and creative team deserve a little grace period, especially under such hectic circumstances. But it's not love at first sight. Ironically, the new CBS sitcom that has been holding the Inc. time slot for the last 5 weeks was Love at First Sight. I'm talking about Pearl, starring Rhea Perlman and Malcolm McDowell. So where's the irony? Well, Rhea Perlman used to be on Cheers with Ted Danson, and Malcolm McDowell used to be married to Mary Steenburgen. Even in network TV, it's a small, small world.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we have an interview with B.B. King, so we'll close today's show with his 1955 recording of Every Day I Have the Blues. B.B. King recorded in 1955. Tomorrow, he'll talk with us about his music and his life. He has a new autobiography called Blues All Around Me. I'm Cherie Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.